Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we will be exploring some of the history of the sexual revolution. And our guest for the program is David Allen. He is a writer and historian, has produced a book that's titled Make Love, Not War, The Sexual Revolution, An Unfettered History. The book was first published in hardcover last year and recently has come out in a paperback edition. It's published by Routledge. So if you're interested in the subject, you can certainly seek out the book. David Allen is a graduate of Brown University. He also holds a PhD from Harvard. He's taught at Princeton. He's now working as a journalist and writer. His articles have appeared in a number of publications, including The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, The New York Times, and The Journal of American Studies. He has also lectured on the sexual revolution at conferences and colleges across the country. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions and comments are welcome. All we ask of people who are calling in is just that they try to keep their comments brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Allen, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
At the height of the sexual revolution, how old were you?
Well, I was born in 1969, so I suppose I was about three or four.
Well, I'm not. This is not intended to be some suggestion that, you know, you have no business talking about it. But I asked that question, and then the next question is, what is it that interested you in exploring the history of the sexual revolution?
Well, you know, though I was three or four, I saw it. In my parents divorced, my father started, you know, he was a single bachelor in the 70s and was dating flight attendants and practicing his pickup skills. And, you know, I read The Joy of Sex and all of those, you know, all of the public, you know, the things that were on the coffee table back then. And I'd always wondered, you know, really what was the sexual revolution? And I think that as somebody who didn't live through it exactly, I was able to bring a sort of fresh perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you would, in a very literal way, you were a child of the sexual revolution.
Exactly. And as a child, you see things very differently than when you're living, you know, when you're a participant.
Sure. Well, the very first sentence of this book, of the introduction, is indeed the question, and that is, what was the sexual revolution? And it seems that as one starts thinking about it, it doesn't take very long before you start to think perhaps what we're talking about here is not perhaps one revolution,
exactly,
but a whole bunch of revolutions, because under this heading, you have things like the coming of the oral contraceptive, you have the abandonment of the notion that women were supposed to be virgins when they got married. We have the women's movement, we have the gay rights movement, we have Roe v. Wade, we have increasing commercialization of sex and relaxation of censorship. Even under in this period, one of the things you write about is the end of laws against interracial marriage. This is an awful lot of territory that we refer to by this shorthand of sexual revolution.
That's a very good point. And, you know, the notion of what the sexual revolution was kept changing and kept evolving during the period, and that was one of the things that really interested me.
Mm. And I was also interested that the very term sexual revolution was coined in the 1920s,
mm-hmm,
by a German psychoanalyst, Wilhelm Reich.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and he was a disciple of Freud, but he was also a Marxist, and he believed that sexual liberation would truly transform society and would end violence and war. And really, the idea, make love, not war, can be traced really all the way back to Reich, and he was eventually rejected by Freud and had to flee Europe and came to the States, but he was eventually persecuted here as well,
mm-hmm,
went to jail, and his books were burned.
It's, I guess, one reason why that kind of date, the 20s, pops out is that I think some people would argue that this thing that we call the sexual revolution really began in the 1920s, and that it was knocked off track by a kind of cultural retrenchment that came during the Depression and then during World War II. But in fact, there is a kind of continuity between the 20s and the 60s.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And as a historian, I believe that you have to really look at things over time and see the developments over time. I chose to focus on the 60s and the early 70s because that was the particular period where you had a certain conjunction of events. You had the pill, you had changes in the laws, and it was really the time at which for a young, unmarried, middle-class woman, especially a middle-class white woman, it was really the first time where premarital sex became not only okay, it actually became the norm.
Well, it's interesting that that perhaps the opening shot was the publication, that the place that you start was the publication of Sex and the Single Girl by Helen Gurley Brown. Now, I have to admit that I've not read this. And I know, I expect you have, and I wonder if you look at that in with the eyes that we have today, given everything that we've been through, how does it strike one today?
Well, it's a terribly written book. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, it's poorly written, but it's very interesting because it was written. It was published in '62, a time of extraordinary optimism about society. You know, the economy was very strong. People felt a lot of opportunity. And Helen Gurley Brown she had stayed single for much longer than was considered appropriate. I think she got married at the age of in her 30s. And she said, look, I had sex before I got married. You know, I'm okay. My friends did it too. They're okay. We had a lot of fun. You can too. And it was a turning point for the culture. And at the same time, you can even see back then, I write about some of the critical responses to the book. Some men found the book very threatening. People said this was going to, you know, really undermine the gender roles in society. So I think it really marked a turning point.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, some people look back at this time and say that there was an explosion of premarital sex, and that this was a major departure from what had gone before. Other people, I think, would suggest, no, that's naive, that in fact people were having sex, and that in fact one of the things that we saw was also at the same time perhaps a great increase in out-of-wedlock births. And some people say, well, that won't tell you whether you know, people were having sex or how much sex they were having, because you have to remember the fact that there would have been a time when if a couple had sex and a woman got pregnant, they got married.
Exactly.
And that was a big change. So
exactly.
I'm taking a long time to get to this question, but I guess what happened, one of the things that happened was we moved away from this idea that women had to be virgins when they got married and that there was something wrong with the woman if she was interested in sex. So, though, is there any way to get a good handle on who was having sex before and who was having sex after, and whether in fact that there was a big increase in sexual activity around this time, and was it that people were doing it more, or was it just that they were talking about it more?
Well, the simple answer to your question is no. There is no way to get a good handle on it, but you know, we do know that in 1959. The teen pregnancy rate peaked in the United States, which most people don't realize. And so that's, you know, more teens were having children, you know, in 1959 than today. But as you said, they were getting married, and that's what shifted. But also what shifted, as you said, was the acceptability of talking about, of acknowledging what you're doing. And, you know, for a young woman in the 50s, to acknowledge publicly that she was having sex before marriage would lead to her essentially, you know, her ostracism from society, from her friends, by her family. It had major repercussions and consequences.
Hmm. So, pardon me, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, people were doing it, but they weren't talking about it, and that was a critical shift.
There had to be more to it than Helen Gurley Brown. What do you think was going on that it made it more acceptable for women to be seen as sexual, to be seen as interested in sex and having sex before getting married.
One of the reasons I chose Helen Gurley Brown was really as representative of some of the changes that were happening in society. So you had more and more women entering the workforce, and they had their own income, and that gave them more freedom. They were living on their own. They had greater independence from their parents. And also, there's a really interesting line in the book where she says, feel free to sleep with your boss, and if it doesn't work out, just get another job. You know, that tells you something about that particular time in our society. You know, it was such a strong economy. People felt like, if they didn't like one job, they'd just go get another. That in and of itself gives a certain amount of sexual freedom to an individual, because prior to that, if a boss didn't like what you did, didn't like the way your hair looked, or didn't like the way you dressed, they would, fire you. There was always the threat of losing your job. Now the young baby boomer employee held the upper hand. So you had a lot of changes. You had the explosion of the baby boom. You had the civil rights movement, and then, of course, the war in Vietnam. And the culture as a whole was shifting dramatically.
Let me introduce again real quickly our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with writer-historian David Allen, and he is the author of the book Make Love, Not War, The Sexual Revolution and Unfettered History, published by Routledge. It first came out last year. It's now out in paperback. And if you're interested in reading, you can look at it. And your questions, of course, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the things that you did in the course of writing the book is to spend time interviewing people, some people famous, well-known figures, others just the average John and Jane Does of the sexual revolution, many of whom aren't actually named. And I'm interested in one particular point, because I think that some people have argued, for all that we said that women now were free to express themselves sexually, it was okay for them to want to have sex and to have sex, and that with the contraceptive, it made it possible to have a reliable method of contraception, so that the risk of pregnancy was gone. Having said all that, I think there are some people who would still argue that the main beneficiaries of the sexual revolution were in fact men and not women. And I wonder, as you went and you talked to people about this, whether you got some sense from folks that you talked to that was in fact true, that somehow that if this was turned out to have been a better deal for the men than it was for the women?
I actually don't. I think it was a better deal for the women, to tell you the truth. I think there was a time, especially in the 70s, where women felt really like they had no choice but to have sex. But I think that in the long scheme of things, I mean, I think for young men in America, you could always find, a prostitute or somebody to have sex with. But for women, it was the risks were so much greater. If it were not pregnancy, then just being kicked out of your home, the risks were much, much higher. The stakes were much higher. So I think that for them, in the long term, it has been much more important.
Mm. Well, given that we're talking about the sexual revolution as if you'll pardon this lame metaphor, but as something of the jigsaw puzzle where a lot of pieces come together to make the whole picture. At the same time, you sort of wonder, well, are there certain pieces that if that piece was removed, that somehow it wouldn't be the same? And it seems that if there was perhaps one thing that one could find as being that important, it would be the oral contraceptive.
Yes, I think the pill was obviously extremely important, not just because it allowed women to control their own, reproduction and to facilitate contraception. But it had several other implications as well. One, it allowed the press to write about sexuality and write about sexual freedom in a whole new way, but with an optimistic, truly American, scientific, technological spin that hadn't been before. And that transformed public discourse in the country.
That gets another point, an interesting point, and that I think Europeans particularly like to scoff at Americans about a lot of things, but our attitudes towards sex probably pretty high on the list.
Right.
And they regard us as being still rather adolescent in our approach to this. There does seem to be something in the sexual revolution that is particularly American, and maybe it is this surprising tendency that we have. While we are, I think, on the one hand, a rather conservative nation, we tend to go to excesses. And this was certainly a case of that. Is there some way in which you think that the sexual revolution was a distinctly American phenomenon?
Definitely. I mean, first of all, the 60s, of course, were, a utopian time in general. But the sexual revolution had its own utopian streak to it, its own... there were those who were very cynical and were merely interested in selling, you know, pornography and capitalizing. But even that, in its own way, is very American, right? You know, see the opportunity for profit in any social movement, but it was also deeply, deeply idealistic. And in a way, people, what they hoped for in the sexual revolution was a freedom from sex, that if we could simply get away from all of our, you know, if we could talk about it enough and if we could get away from our shame and inhibition, we'd be actually less interested in sex. And I think that's very interesting, paradoxical, and very American.
Mm. Well, we have a caller to talk with. Others are certainly welcome. We'll start here with caller in Peoria. It's line number 4. Hello?
Yes, good morning. During World War II, the mothers and the boyfriends, a lot of these young ladies, they said, the GI is overpaid, oversexed, and over here.
Yeah, I guess we could just let that comment stand. I'm not sure where to go with that. You want to comment on that, Mr. Hill?
Yeah, I think it's great to bring in World War II and the changes that the war brought in itself. You know, young men came back from Europe; they had seen a different world, and yet the 50s in America demanded a kind of domesticity that. Was in tension with that. And I think the sexual revolution in many ways was an explosion against the constricting demands of the 50s.
Mm. The point of the caller suggests that sometimes people, they think they've discovered something, like people in the 60s suddenly thought they discovered sex, when in fact it had been going on for some time.
Right.
And that probably anything you could think of doing, people had done and had done it a long time ago.
Yes. And young people in the 60s thought they discovered many things, politics, new hairstyles, lots of things.
Well, that gets us to maybe we talked a little bit about the counterculture, because I think in a lot of people's minds, the sexual revolution and the counterculture are associated. And it certainly seems true that the people who are involved in the counterculture embrace the idea of sexual freedom. But one wonders just to what extent those two things, the sexual revolution and the counterculture, really had to do with one another. And again, the counterculture, one of those things where, well, if it hadn't been, would the sexual revolution have gone on anyway?
Right. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was that most of the books on the 60s, on the politics or on the counterculture, tend to leave out the sexual revolution. They tend to focus on the music, or they tend to focus on the politics or, the war, and the sexual revolution gets a brief nod. In the counterculture, especially in communes, you had a real questioning of notions of property and ownership and possessiveness. And the minute you start to question possessiveness and property, then you start questioning marriage and monogamy and romantic love. And so in many of the communes, you had either group marriage or group relationships or open relationships, and a lot of nudity, because people wanted to get past ideas about bodily shame, and you see a real connection there.
Hmm. But indeed, was this one of those things that if there was no counterculture, we think that sexual revolution probably it would have happened anyway?
Well, I don't think you can separate the two. I think the two were deeply integrated and influenced and colored one another. The sexual revolution was so influenced by and then influenced in turn the music and the art, the theater of the 60s and 70s, that it you just can't, you can't, you know, unmesh them. But I think that, on the other hand, the sexual revolution was in some sense broader and touched in a way more people's lives than the counterculture, because it had implications for people who were much older, you know, for people who were already married, who already had families. Experimenting with sexual freedom was a way, in a sense, to participate in the counterculture slightly, or participate in the transformations of the 60s without necessarily abandoning mainstream culture. Mm.
Well, is it fair to say that the sexual revolution really did cut across class lines?
Well, you know, you're talking about a time where so many people, where affluence is so powerful in society that class is probably at its least polarizing.
Mm.
So I think, you know, you have more and more, you know, blacks entering the middle class, and I think it cut across all of American culture. When I say that, I want to stress that for some people, you know, for a very small number of people, they were participating in the sexual revolution wholeheartedly. You know, they were going to, and a very small number of people, were going to sex clubs or were, you know, having swingers parties. And then for a larger number of people, they were not doing that, but, say, going to sexually explicit films or, you know, talking about sex in a way that they wouldn't have in another time. And then for an even larger number of people, they were, you know, buying the joy of sex and leaving it on their coffee table. So I think that a tremendous number of people were touched by it, but not all to the same degree.
We have another caller here again, somebody on our toll-free line, on line number 4. Hello?
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
This is kind of a question as far as capitalizing on it or being a leader in it. Where did Playboy magazine play in the revolution? I know that Hugh Hefner wrote a series of articles in the early 60s, like every month. I think they were even titled The Sexual Revolution.
They were titled The Playboy Philosophy.
Yeah, that's right, The Playboy Philosophy. And so the question is, was he a promoter or a capitalizer on the revolution?
I think that's a very good question, and I did go out to the mansion and talk to Hugh Hefner, and he's very, very interested in securing his role as a historical figure, and I think he was certainly important, and I think that I love that you mentioned the Playboy philosophy, because I think that is why he was important. You know, he's often credited with having liberated, you know, magazines and erotica. But I think actually the Playboy philosophy is more interesting, because he was really the first to take, you know, either a pinup magazine or pornography or whatever you want to call it, and combine it with a kind of social critique. And that was fascinating. He used his magazine as a platform. Now, the magazine itself, which began earlier than the Playboy philosophy, it began in 1953, was really just an extension of the pinup magazine from the 40s or from Esquire, from before that. So the photographs in the magazine weren't nearly as radical as he would like to say they are. But the philosophy was pretty progressive.
It was thought out anyway, and
it was.
You know, and I think back in my college days when I grabbed the magazine, I think that was one of the first, well, it wasn't obviously the first thing I turned to, but it was the first thing I read, and every month it was always quite interesting. I think near the end, he was running out of things to say,
right?
And it wasn't nearly as good as the first articles
or
editorials. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, what was the essence of the Playboy philosophy, do you think?
Well, the essence was, you know, in a liberal society, the individual's sexual needs and sexual rights are just as important as any other rights, and that we shouldn't be constrained by outdated moral views, and that we shouldn't tolerate censorship, and we shouldn't tolerate repression. And Hefner, you know, came out in favor of gay rights and saw himself. Now, many people would disagree with this, but he saw himself as a feminist because he believed in women's sexual equality.
Hmm. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest this morning in this first hour of Focus 580, writer-historian David Allen, and we're talking about his book, Make Love, Not War, The Sexual Revolution and Unfettered History. It's published by Routledge. It was first published last year and is now out in a paperback edition. So if you're interested in reading the book, you should be able to find it. And, of course, your questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. How much do you think of the what we call the sexual revolution really was all about the commercialization of sex?
Well, again, I think there was a, to use a somewhat old-fashioned word, a dialectic that took place. The commercialization of sex and the is what, in a sense, pushed forward changes in the law and changes in culture. You know, it was very hard for judges to say we should be censoring Henry Miller when you had magazines like Playboy around, you know, or when you had other erotica around. So the two work together. Then I think there came a point where commercialization, in a sense, took over. And at that point, the more idealistic elements lost their place in the movement.
Another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Could I cite some changes in society which occurred during the sexual revolution? The definitive changes occurred during the sexual revolution, and they're still affecting society. For your comment, before the sexual revolution in the 50s, we had virtually no drug problem. There just weren't any drugs. Well, I guess Robert Mitchum was arrested for using marijuana in the 50s. But Life magazine, when reporting that Robert Mitchum had been arrested, had to explain to the American people what marijuana was.
Do you want me to take these one at a time?
Yeah. And
sure.
Of course, now we have a terrific drug problem. Drugs are plaguing our society. Let me just say this: it's not only drugs. Crime started up. Now we have probably a greater percentage of. I think the statistic is that we have a greater percentage of our population now incarcerated than any other advanced industrialized nation. That was not true before the sexual revolution.
Well, that's accurate. It's actually not quite accurate, but there's actually no connection between the sexual revolution and drugs or crime. But, I mean, we've always had... I'm actually fascinated by the fact that Americans have... first of all, I want to stress that there's no connection between the sexual revolution and drugs or crime, but I've been fascinated by the fact that a large proportion of Americans have been intoxicated by something. For a large portion of our history, first, opium, and then alcohol, and then the drugs that were used in the 60s, and now Prozac and Ritalin, it's really interesting to me, but that is a completely separate question.
You say that there is no connection between the use of drugs and the sexual revolution. You're telling me that?
Well, only in the sense that the only connection really that I see is that as people used drugs, they were less inhibited, so they were more willing to try things that they weren't willing to try before.
You bet they were. As a matter of fact, before the sexual revolution, people who used drugs were called dope fiends.
But you've got your logic backwards. It's not because of the sexual revolution that drugs are more popular. I mean, it doesn't work that way.
We saw during the Vietnamese War, of course, the younger generation was rebelling against the older generation during the Vietnamese War, and that was what largely brought on the sexual revolution. But I can remember on television, on the news programs, prior to the sexual revolution, the people who would have used drugs were called dope fiends. But we saw on television news the soldiers in Vietnam passing around joints, smoking them up the barrels of their rifles. Yeah. I mean, those pictures, and that was celebrated. That was approved. In other words, there was a sea change, a cultural change.
I think, let me just, because I don't, I mean, I think in one sense the caller and the guest are in agreement about the issue of drugs, but not in the connection between the two. So having, let's say we're not going to get,
okay.
We're going to go further than that. But if you have another, yeah, let's go on if you have another issue, yeah.
Prior to the sexual revolution, one baby in five One baby in 25, I should say, was born out of wedlock. In 1950, about one baby in 25 was born out of wedlock, and we had no abortion. Abortion was outlawed.
No, but there was plenty of abortion. Abortion was illegal. It was just done under...
I beg your pardon.
I mean, they were barbaric. We've had abortion in this country since the founding of the country itself.
There always has been some abortions, but now in these late years, we're having in excess of a million babies a year aborted. At the height of abortion, we had 1.5 million babies. We're aborting about one third of the babies who are conceived in our country now. Prior to the 60s, about one baby in 25 was born out of wedlock. Now one baby in three is born out of wedlock, despite abortion. And whereas venereal diseases were almost unknown, they were virtually unknown in the middle class. And in the middle class, there were only two venereal diseases that were even known about. I think there were five venereal diseases that were studied in medical schools. Now, one in four of our young people is actively infected with a venereal disease. One in five Americans has herpes. The CDC a few years ago said that there were now 57 socially transmitted diseases. How about that?
There was a time when syphilis was considered a major social disgrace and was a horrible, crippling disease. And we, discovered penicillin, and its ramifications became less serious. HIV is a tragedy, and herpes has, severe consequences if you become pregnant.
Please don't miss the point. The point is that prior to the sexual revolution in the 50s, there were virtually no venereal diseases in the middle class. They were just simply unknown. And now, one in four of our young people one in four of those young people in that high school hall has a venereal disease.
Right, but the only reason that they were virtually unheard of in the 50s is because penicillin had solved the syphilis problem. Whereas at one point syphilis had been a very, very major problem in society. I mean, there were anti-syphilis days, there were marches in the streets. I mean, it was a huge social issue in the late 19th century.
In other words, you're saying that there has not been an increase in venereal disease?
No, I didn't say that.
This is huge. I mean, this is. We went from virtually flatline, non-existent a situation where venereal diseases were non-existent in the middle class to a place where they are rampant. It's an ongoing epidemic. As a matter of fact, a college of gynecologists just a couple of years ago issued a statement. Made a declaration in which they said we had an ongoing long-term venereal disease epidemic now in the United States. That had never happened before.
Well, I have three other people holding, and I have less than 15 minutes. And Mr. Allen, you want to make any further comment on any of the points the caller raised?
No, I think the caller has a very strong political agenda, and I'm more interested in the historical, looking at it from a broader historical sweep.
Let's continue. We'll go to line number one. The caller is in southeastern Illinois. Hello.
Okay, I've got more thoughts than I probably have time for here with others waiting. One of the things, the increase in the illegitimate children, I wondered if there is, you'd think that France was a fairly sexually free place, but there's been a tremendous increase in illegitimate children. I think about one in every two is illegitimate in France now. So there's been a change other than in actions. Another comment, when Helen Gurley Brown did get married, she married a man who seemingly from their appearances together was old enough to be her father. Another point... A change in the sexual revolution is the change in practices. Seemingly high school girls now provide a service for their boyfriends that prostitutes many prostitutes didn't provide at one time to their customers. Another point, and I don't know if this is a sexual revolution or not, but can anybody explain the rings, the nose rings, the nipple rings, the navel rings, the labia rings, and I guess somebody saying locally there's a girl who has eyebrow rings, not to mention tongue studs and things of that sort. That's probably off the track. If you see anything there that you want to make a comment on, why?
Yeah, I will, actually. I love that you brought up the point about rings and piercings. And I mean, I personally don't have any piercings. I hope my daughter never does. I'm very interested in our sort of obsession with bodily modification. And, you know, very few people know that the major reason that circumcision became so common in the U.S., in the early 20th century and the late 19th century is because doctors believed it would stop masturbation. And that's why a predominantly Gentile Christian society adopted the practice of circumcision, which had previously been almost exclusively Jewish and Muslim. And that reason has been forgotten. It's been lost into the sort of collective unconscious of our society. But I think that's very interesting.
Mm. Just one other point, it seems that to find out what people are doing, what people do sexually, mm-hmm. what they're doing now, what they did 10 years ago, what they did 50 years ago, it's really hard because most people are not really eager to tell you about that, and the people who are, you have to wonder, are they indeed representative of a population at large? We can't seem to shake this idea that somehow people today are doing stuff that they never did before, or that there's somehow some big increase in particular kinds of sexual activities. And I suppose that may be, but it seems that that's something that's very difficult to actually establish one way or another.
That's true. And I think that we also have a very hard time shaking our emotional responses to what other people are doing. You know, the idea that somebody, you know, the caller who was very, very upset about sexually transmitted disease, it's, there's a difference between being upset about it in the abstract and sort of having an emotional reaction and then knowing somebody who's dealing with it and you know, being supportive and compassionate and sympathetic for them. It's very different. And we, as a society, and I think this is what is, you know, uniquely American, is our reactiveness about sex. And I think that we learn that very young, and it has persisted. And then one of the things I argue in the book is that goes up and down in some sense in relation to the general attitudes of society. When society is happy and economically prosperous and doing well, people care much less about what their neighbors are doing. When things are stressful and people are scared and fearful about the future, they become much more invested in controlling what their compatriots are doing.
Hmm. On again to line number 2, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. Apropos the caller from Bloomington, Indiana, it just really needs to get some cross-cultural perspective. The Netherlands, which is notorious for its decriminalization of drugs and its quote-unquote sexual libertinism, has a lower teenage birth rate and a lower abortion rate than the U.S. does. So it's a cultural phobia of discussing and acknowledging, I think, that is actually more at the root of this. Also, as vis-a-vis the history, you didn't actually mention also the patent medicine and the fact that cocaine was in coke and that in certain days in the fledgling U.S., Republic, you could get a tincture made to your satisfaction, cocaine, paregoric, and all sorts of things. It's kind of a lesser told story, but drugs have been ubiquitous for a long time.
They have. We have been, intoxicated in some form or another throughout our history.
Yeah. Sometimes fundamentalism is an intoxication, too, I think.
And some, what's interesting is which forms of intoxication are allowed, you know, so that those that allow people to, you know, work more efficiently, like Prozac, are, you know, more encouraged than those that allow people to enjoy their leisure more.
And cocaine in its day, and the Coca-Cola that kept you going. But actually, my impetus to call was to think about what I was reading in those days, because I think there was a preoccupation in that days of the so-called psychopathology of everyday life kind of argument. And you mentioned the guy with the Oregon therapy, which was, I can't remember his name. Right, in the 20s. But that kind of, since the college campus was sort of repeatedly a focus for this, there were a lot of people that were doing more reading about it than were doing it, I think.
That's true. And I think that that's right you brought that up, because I think that ideas about sex and books were really important in the 60s. You had writers like Herbert Marcuse, and his books were very popular.
I was thinking of Norman O'Brown, Life Against
Absolutely.
Body, George Leonard, who more was a popularizer.
And Robert Rimmer. I don't know if you remember him, but he wrote The Harrod Experiment. And The Harrod Experiment was a huge bestseller about a fictional college where men and women were paired up as roommates and expected to have sex together. And I went out and met with Rimmer. He recently died, but I met with him at his home and his wife up in Boston. And he was very interesting because he himself had had a group marriage with another couple for about 30 years. And on the one hand, they lived this very traditional suburban life, and yet they were true social radicals in another way.
Yeah, the other thing I didn't mention was there was this preoccupation with gestalt therapy, too. But also, well, there was recently, upwelling of discussion in the community here about, what is the buzzword for it now, polyamory?
Which is what was called group marriage or open marriage in the 60s and 70s, but it's now called polyamory, yes.
Which, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Exactly. I think that's very true.
The last person on, I think.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to line number three. This is Urbana. Hello.
Yeah. First of all, this isn't what I called about, but the man who was talking about the... lack of drugs previously. I went to a parochial high school in Chicago in the early 50s, and I can remember being dragged in to chapel one week for every afternoon and having these horrible films run past us and being shown how we could be caught by opium and heroin and codeine and several of the other things that have been mentioned since. So the problem about that kind of thing has been around always.
Yeah.
Okay. The reason I really called was I would like to have the man address the question of the fact that this country was formed on not religious freedom, but many, many of the people who came here because they were getting away from an established religion in Europe,
mm-hmm.
especially in this part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that when you finally get down to the, second generation of Americans, that finally fades away. And
it's really interesting because one of the things that I learned in doing the research for the book that I really didn't know was the extent to which priests and ministers and clergy in the 60s were reexamining morality and reexamining religion and reexamining the New Testament and saying, wait a minute, why are we so concerned with telling people what they can't do when really the focus of the New Testament is on love? And there was what was called the new morality of the late 60s and early 70s, and it wasn't a morality about what you can't do. It was a morality about, relationships and about it was a logical ethics.
Yeah.
And in 68, when the when Rome decreed the birth control, that the pill was illicit, there was a huge outcry among young priests in America, and many signed documents disagreeing with Rome, and it was a major crisis for the church. And I didn't know anything about that.
Well, I think it does. If you look into a little further, I think that whole thing has a long history and influence on exactly your topic.
Yes.
Okay, let's try and get at least one more person here. We'll go to Champagne. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if you addressed this already because I was sort of out of the conversation for a while, but while we're talking about the different pieces of the puzzle in, maybe the late 50s or the early 1960s that went into the sexual revolution, I would... other historians have written about, at that exact time, the emerging power of the image.
Emerging power of?
The image.
Image,
And they always point to, you know, like the Kennedy-Nixon debate and the fact that Kennedy was so much more telegenic.
I'm having a hard time hearing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, things like television and the power of images.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Kennedy was telegenic, you know,
that
didn't hurt his career. And I'm wondering if you could maybe, if you see ties between the increased power of imagery in the sexual revolution. In other words, you know, pictures and images of people's bodies and how people look from the outside and how they appear, if that has something to do with this.
Absolutely. I think that's an excellent point. You know, the proliferation of film in and of itself transformed American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to see people's bodies. And now, of course, you'd had film in the, you know, early on, and then you'd had the production code and censorship. But as film became, you know, as you had color, and as it became cheaper to make film, and you had it more and more widely distributed, and you also had imports of film from Europe, where the body was presented in, you know, if you want to say more realistic ways. And that had a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. And do you see, I mean, a lot of people at color seem to be talking about sort of after effects. And, I mean, can you comment on what you see as going on today? Because from my perspective, a lot of times, it looks to me like when we talk about sex in our culture today, we're talking less about individual freedom and individual fulfillment and individual liberation,
mm-hmm.
and more about looks.
right.
Sort of a superficial sexuality, as
definitely
opposed to like a social revolution where the individual was supposed to be fulfilled.
Right, and I think that there's something that's very really interesting about our culture, and that is that, you know, the body can be used almost with full freedom in for advertising to sell products.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a certain amount of both eroticism and commercialism at work.
Mm-hmm.
But the naked body, you know, the simple naked body is almost non-existent.
Right.
Almost impossible to find images of. You know, if you flip open Time magazine or Newsweek magazine and there is an article on prostate cancer, you know, you're not going to see just a photo of a naked man or a photo of the genitals. You know, you're not going to have it. You know, so often that classic representation of, you know, the Da Vinci, you know, male, you know, the genitals are just not there, and we have a very conflicted sense about the body. You know, it's okay to sell products, and if it's sexual, but if it's just the body, that in and of itself is more threatening.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to the caller for cutting in. We've simply used our time, and perhaps that's not such a bad place to stop. There's much more in the book if you're interested. It's titled Make Love, Not War, The Sexual Revolution, An Unfettered History, published by Routledge by David Allen. Mr. Allen, thanks very much for talking
with
us today. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.